This is the ACIA New Horizons podcast. Everything we discuss is for the analyst, to the analyst, and by the analyst. Today, I'm joined by Professor Sherman. Some of you may know him as the founder of evidence-based policing. He is also a professor at the University of Cambridge and has served as the honorary president of the Society of Evidence-Based Policing since its formation in 2010. Professor Sherman began his career in the New York City Police Department in 1971 as a civilian analyst in the Office of the Commissioner. Following this, he has designed field research and experiments in over 30 police agencies. Professor Sherman, it's an absolute honour to have you on our podcast.
Thanks so much, Paige. Great to be here.
Professor Sherman, let's start with talking then about the apprenticeship and what the intelligence analyst apprenticeship training is going to offer our analysts and other police officials.
The Cambridge approach to the national standard for the intelligence analyst apprenticeship is going to offer a new pathway to meeting that standard, which is something that the Department for Education's Institute of Apprenticeships and Further Education is encouraging. Because rather than creating a different apprenticeship for every industry, they'd like to have general approaches to the same general skills, but with specific settings differing. So for example, the intelligence analyst apprenticeship was designed to meet the needs of defense, of military intelligence, of business intelligence, of intelligence across a wide range of sectors. And we've been working for over two decades on intelligence analysis in policing that is based on more rigorous use of quantitative and qualitative evidence. So what we're hoping to do is to provide a way that the Metropolitan Police asked us to serve that great gap in in-service training between sergeants and superintendents. So there's a vast number in England who are getting relatively little training in the prediction of crime, the prevention of crime, and the tracking of both victims and offenders, as well as police officers' efforts to follow developing crime situations with specific units like neighborhoods or hotspots or offenders and victims themselves, as well as criminal networks and specific county lines. All of this is highly amenable to the kind of quantitative analytics supported by qualitative insight that we have been using in our master's program at Cambridge for 25 years. And now it's going to be available at no cost to anybody who works in an English police agency. And we're hoping that this is going to be a real tipping point for spreading evidence-based policing around the English police service.
Yes. And I guess, something what I guess you want to strive for, sort of a standardized practice across all 43 police forces. And, Professor Sherman, despite you discussing these issues over 20 years ago, this is, still not routinely accepted in forces. I assume that you found a gap through your own research that this is needed. It's vital to provide, build those bridges between each role within the police force. So in terms of the lessons you have learned around how to embed EBP and raise its profile, would you argue that this apprenticeship is definitely the starting point to do this?
People who haven't had the opportunity to take master's degree level education, it is clearly the best starting point that we can offer at this point. And, you asked about our identifying the gap. The whole concept of evidence-based policing was inspired by evidence-based medicine, which didn't emerge until 1992. But there were all these arguments among doctors about what's the best way to deal with any specific disease, whether surgery or chemotherapy for cancer or immunotherapy, for example, works best, different treatments for heart disease. All of these things were subject to opinion, but it was also a growing body of evidence, up to a million clinical trials by the early 90s, that many doctors were ignoring because they were pretty set in their ways and didn't care much about new evidence to find ways to save more lives and to help heal people when they get sick. So this is a big controversy in medicine to try to ensure that there were ways of providing the best evidence for the best decisions for patients when the new research came out. And evidence-based medicine is still, shall we say, far from universal. We've known since the 1840s that doctors should wash their hands before they go from one patient to the next, and doctors still aren't doing it. The National Academy of Sciences in the United States estimates that 100,000 people a year die in the U.S. from infections that are caused by doctors who simply won't wash their hands. So what we do with putting evidence into the workplace is give people the choice that they can use the best evidence or they can ignore it. But it at least creates within a team the opportunity for one member of the team to say, now, hang on, what's the evidence about this decision? And is it the best decision we can make, whether it's how to target our resources, what the effect will be of the strategy we're choosing, and then a month down the road, what's the evidence on whether we're actually doing it? You know, the equivalent of our doctors washing their hands, our police patrolling in hotspots at least 15 minutes a day. They've both been tested rigorously. They both work. And in both cases, it's not really happening very much. So this is all part of the challenge of thinking analytically about what we do in policing and whether it's not just for analysts to worry about that. It's for sergeants, inspectors, chief inspectors, superintendents, as well as the analysts, as well as civilians working on violence reduction units and other ways of trying to make communities safer. We want to bring them all together in this apprenticeship, which will take up about 20% of their time for either study or a project that they will work on in their workplace to apply better knowledge, better intelligence analysis from good evidence to improving police outcomes and making communities safer places. Everybody agrees we need communities to be safer. The violence levels are too high. The racial disparity in homicide victimization is 5-1 nationally. It's 24-1 for young people. And we've simply got a lot to get done. And we can't get it done by better guesswork. It needs to have better analysis. And that's for everybody, not just the analysts.
Absolutely. Yes. And I guess this will, you know, help enrich the decision-making process, because you're right in saying, you know, it's not just the analyst that needs to understand these analytical tools. It is everyone that is involved in the tasking stage and the decision-making stage. So when you sent over the apprenticeship booklet, the prospectus of it, I read about, you know, this is based on enriching the process of intelligence. But as you know, thinking and being a researcher myself in this sort of field of work, I thought, you know, it's not a one size fits all as such. So, you know, intelligence and the operation of intelligence can vary within each police service and even within each police departments internationally. So how will you ensure that this training will be suitable for each police service and individual learning?
Well, that's the great thing about this apprenticeship, because so much of it is the project that the apprentices will undertake to make a difference in their own workplace with the analysis that they will do using the tools that are provided by our apprenticeship. So, you know, an apprenticeship is not about how to make one kind of car. It's not about how to farm one kind of field for one kind of crop. It's a set of facts and concepts that can be put together to solve all kinds of problems. So the one size that fits all is not the solution. It's the method of thinking it through, of gathering the data, of analyzing it. And give you a good example is the power few. The concept of the power few has been cited by our thousands of students as one of the most revelatory things that they have learned in our courses. If 4% of the victims in Dorset suffer 85% of the harm from crime, that huge concentration in the power few victims is not generally matched by investing in those victims in a proactive way to try to prevent further harm from repeat victimization. And we can look at repeat victimization, which was a very popular idea 30 years ago, but it doesn't capture the concentration within repeat victims of most of the harm in a very small proportion of the group. Similarly, hotspots of crime, which we discovered in Minneapolis in the 1980s, where under 5% of the addresses produced over 50% of all of the crimes. And what that means is that in most cities, even places like London or New York, there's never any crime. There's never any serious crime. There's never any crime at all in a lot of these areas. And they get patrolled, they get resources, they have calls given priority to those areas when the history shows that there's not going to be a justification for that investment of resources at the expense of withholding resources from places and people who the intelligence analysis would show are much more at risk of high harm. And so by trying to make better decisions about where is the scarce resource of policing going to do the most good, we are able to, I think, do more with the same amount, or even if we get 20,000 more constables, and if it grows by a net of 20,000, we still have places in England where it takes several days for a police car to get to the scene of a requested high priority call, but not an immediate call. We're still, I think, facing good challenges to resolve through analysis. And one of the ways to do that is through testing things like video policing and looking at experiments in which you either send a police car that will get there in 8 hours or 4 hours or whenever, compared to a uniformed police officer in a video screen talking to you within 2 minutes of your calling the police. Yeah. And the police agencies that we're working with, which have people going through our training, are pioneering these new methods of policing with the concepts and tools that we teach in this apprenticeship course.
And would you say that there's flexibility for those that will be involved to argue their sort of points on what they think works best and, you know, areas of like recommendations? Would you say it's flexible for that kind of attitude?
Well, it's certainly flexible about gathering the evidence to test a hypothesis. But that's really the big difference between law and science.
Yes.
And people in policing have generally been brought up in a culture of law in which you take your side in an argument and then you try to prove it. And that's not the way you build bridges. That's not the way you conquer diseases. That's not the way that we wiped out smallpox. And I hope we can eventually do it with COVID. You have to solve problems. And it's not a question about winning an argument. It's about testing a hypothesis to see if your theory is correct. And if it's not, then you try another hypothesis. Because the question is, how do we solve this problem? And by using the standard methods of science in your intelligence analysis, then you can see when you're wrong and when you're right and make decisions based on the truth rather than what your opinion is. And it's that big shift from opinion to fact that is a culture shock when you are used to trying to prove your case, as opposed to what science says is you can't prove a hypothesis, you can only disprove it. And just because you haven't disproven a hypothesis doesn't mean that it's right. If you know that you can describe the places where a crime is most likely to happen in the next 6 months, in the next year, in the next 2 weeks, because you've done it with data thousands of times showing that that's a correct prediction, then it's like meteorology, you know. But people don't have arguments about whether it's going to rain tomorrow. They just have data, and they use the same tools to predict weather in England as they do in Australia. It's very different weather, but the tools are the same.
Yes. And I guess it comes down to, you know, it's when we read on intelligence and we discuss intelligence within police forces, it's rather much, you know, it's intelligence-led policing rather than policing-led intelligence. And I think removing those mental modes sometimes within our police forces is very important. And this, I think, apprenticeship is definitely something that can achieve that. So this apprenticeship is for analysts, chief inspectors, sergeants, detectives, and constables. And it's also open to professionals who work with policing. So that can be individuals for mental health trusts, child protection services. It's very broad. You're really opening this up to a lot of people here.
Yes, and I'm grateful for you pointing that out, because We think that police increasingly work in a multi-agency context, but the people in social services, family support, health, education, et cetera, they have no way to get exposed to the patterns of crime, to the prediction of crime, the prevention of crime, and what we know about what works and what doesn't work in that domain. One example for the education sector is the idea of taking at-risk kids who've been troublemakers in school and taking them to prison and showing them what life is like in prison. It's called Scared Straight. And it's been tested 7 times. And every time what it does is to increase their risk of crime, not decreasing it. And yet a lot of people say, oh, that sounds like a cool idea. Let's take those kids to prison and really scare them. I don't think it's going to happen in British prisons right now, but it's a good example of how the intuitive sounds like a good idea has to fight with the evidence-based intelligence analysis showing, no, it actually backfires. Don't take those kids to prison and try to scare them. And with more of that sort of knowledge floating around the multi-agency consultations, it makes people more cautious, I think, about jumping into a good idea or even picking a target for somebody who you say, oh, this person's really dangerous or this person's really at risk, without looking at every possible person on the list and using the best intelligence you have to say, this person is the one who's most at risk. And that should be here are the top five. We should be working on them. And not just because you had a recent contact with number 158. And very often these multi-agency meetings will have this kind of person-focused, anecdote-based decision-making process to which our graduates are saying things like, now hang on, let's look at the evidence. Let's look at every possible case, rank order them, see which ones have the strongest prediction of high harm, and let's prioritize them.
Absolutely. And like you said, it encourages that multi-agency, you know, work, that partnership, which is so vital to all investigations. So what will then all of the individuals I've just mentioned who can actually take part within this course, what are they going to get out of this that they don't already know?
We have some testimonial videos that are going to go on our website, in which we have some chief inspectors from the Met and some other forces talking about the most important things they learned in our courses. One thing is the concept of the crime harm index, in which all crimes are not created equal, but each crime has a recommended sentencing guideline measured in the number of days of imprisonment that a first offender should get. And that whole way of thinking about resource allocation, not just counting the number of crimes in different places or individuals' records, but weighting the crimes so that more serious crimes are given more emphasis in decision-making about setting priorities. Another good example is organized crime groups. And some of our research projects at Cambridge have actually ranked the organized crime groups, not just by the number of crimes or the number of participants, but by the crime harm index value of the crimes that they are associated with through intelligence. And the main comment that our students, both leaders and analysts, have made about that is that it completely changed the way they think about analyzing crime to use the index approach rather than raw counts. Another thing they get is the power few concept. And then after that, they use the triple T, that is that you have to first target the selected number of units you have the money and the resources to deal with and pick those that will have the most yield. Then you have to test or rely on tested methods to see which ones would work best with those targets. And then you have to track, as the third T, target, test, and track, are we doing what we said we would do? Are the crimes going down with that target the way we want them to? And if they're not, is it because we're not delivering the police strategy that we agreed would be most relevant? A good example of that is through these preventive patrol deliveries in hotspots, where they're supposed to go 15 minutes at a time, generally 3 times a day is recommended. What the tracking often shows is that you're lucky if you can get it once a day. We're now developing digital tracking alarms to show if a hotspot hasn't had a single patrol visit for 3 or 4 days. One experiment shows that harm levels go up 80% after the fourth day. And so preventive patrol matters. It needs to be tracked, and it needs to be the subject of supervisory action when the policy is not being delivered. And this is a really big change in the way of thinking about what police do. It's leading to things like assigning a preventive patrol job. Here, your job is not to answer this call, but to go to this place for 15 minutes and to get out of the car, to talk to people, to be seen and to see what's going on. And the evidence is very clear that that's going to reduce crime, but only in those places that the intelligence analysis identifies as being high harm and high crime in public place kinds of crime, as opposed to crime taking place indoors. All of that takes a lot of precision. And precision in policing has never been more important than it is today. So what people get out of our course is good examples of how precision matters and how they can go back to their workplace and make policing as precise as surgery so that we don't have as much waste or even harm by overusing things like stop and search in low crime areas where it's causing a lot of trouble and it's not doing any good, and concentrating stop and search where a lot of people are carrying knives. And if you can discourage knife carrying, you'll reduce the number of stabbings.
Yes, and I, what you said that you're going to hope they're hopefully going to be able to achieve by completing this course is you've got a good set of consultants on this journey with you, and all of them come from different backgrounds and with different expertise. So I guess that's another, you know, a great thing for the those that will get involved. They can always sort of reach out to yourself and these consultants for sort of extra sort of help and support when conducting their investigations. So Professor Sherman, I'd like to know, what sort of findings are you thinking you're going to discover?
Well, for the last 25 years, we've been getting future police leaders to write research theses, and a lot of them have been published, and they've discovered incredibly important things that refine our ability to target, to test, and to track. And I think the more people who are engaged in research for better policing, what's often called pracademic research or practitioner academics, what we're going to find is a lot of people who haven't had exposure to these ideas, but who absolutely get turned on. It's what Yates said about education not being filling up a bucket, but starting a fire. And what we want to start is a fire of curiosity in the minds and hearts of people who take this course, so they spend the rest of their careers trying to learn more about the causes and solutions to the crime problems that they're working with. And that's what's been happening with the master's level course for the last 25 years. It's very expensive. Very few people get access to it. It wasn't online. And now that we have this apprenticeship that's mostly online, we can plug on despite the pandemic, despite COVID, and we can just keep engaging people in these one-on-one tutorials with a screen and a face, but it's a live conversation with a former chief constable or somebody who's been doing crime analysis in police agencies all over the world or conducting experiments with police. We have a really great team, very diverse and very curious themselves, who can talk to every apprentice in this course on a personal basis, not just about what they're learning in the course, but perhaps about how it's received in the workplace and whether people are giving them, you know, a lot of joking about what did you learn at Cambridge and that sort of thing, which can be sometimes challenging, but it's all about trying to do a better job. And that's harder than just doing things the way you've always done them. But I think the kind of people who want to come to this apprenticeship are the ones who want to do better.
Yes, and that's really important. You know, there's sometimes we've spoke to people before myself when I talk to analysts and other individuals in police services. There's not enough regarding their career paths, and they're unsure of where they can go in terms of career development. So exactly what you said, this can, for those that will attend, want to do better and want to be the best they can be in terms of their job. Now, when we discuss policing, you know, it's important to mention the College of Policing, and I would like to know maybe how this agency is going to be able to integrate evidence-based policing into analyst development and also the intelligence profession program in general. Is there any way that the College of Policing will get involved in this and promote it?
Well, from its very beginning, the College of Policing has made evidence-based policing the cornerstone of what they're doing. I was on the planning committee for creating the college, and then I served 5 years on the board of directors of the college, and worked very closely with people like Rachel Tuffin, who is the lead on training there. I know that they are very supportive of the evidence-based policing programs that we've undertaken at Cambridge. They have in the past provided scholarships for our future chief officers to take the master's course. And they're very keen to see many different ways to develop evidence-based policing occurring around the country. We have made every effort to make our teaching congruent not only with the Apprenticeship Institute standard for the intelligence analyst apprenticeship, but also with the College of Policing standards. And we will be working very closely with them to include people from the college in our instructions and our videos and conferences as we have done ever since the college began operations in 2013. We're very lucky to have a College of Policing in this country, which doesn't exist in that kind of form in the United States or even Canada or Australia. And we think the whole use of apprenticeships for police constables and the police college, police constables degree apprenticeship program, which I remember sitting in the board meeting at the College of Policing when the idea first came up, and using the apprenticeship system to fund it. I just almost fell out of my chair with excitement about the huge possibility that was opening up before us. And now it's happening. It's making Britain, I think, the most highly educated and knowledge-based police force in the world. So we're very grateful that the college has been able to do all that and to support the possibility and the interest for our doing what we're doing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm so fortunate to be speaking with you now, and you've done so much work within this field. And like you said, you've probably seen some crazy things before, and now you're living it and you're seeing these developments within our police forces, especially as you've come from New York, and things are very different, most probably out there. It's worth highlighting the cost of this apprenticeship. So we're going to have analysts that are probably listening to this and police officers that might want to get involved, and they maybe want to go speak to their chief constable or superintendent to say, you know, listen, get me on this course. Could you just highlight the cost of this, please?
I'm delighted to highlight the cost of this. It's zero. Anybody who wants to take this apprenticeship course simply has to persuade the apprenticeship management and perhaps the senior leaders, or at least their supervisors in their employers, to register them on the digital apprenticeship system as apprentices in this course. We are on the digital apprenticeship system. If you want to enroll, you should write to our chief administrator, but ultimately it's down to the employer to register each apprentice. And when they do that, where is the money coming from? It's coming from a tax that's already been levied on the employer's payroll. So every employer in England with over 3 million a year in payroll costs has to pay 1/200th of the payroll into the apprenticeship levy fund. And if they don't spend the money, it goes back to Treasury. And as I understand it, most of the money that has been levied, or let me put it another way, most police departments have been giving back some of that levy to Treasury unused. So it's not only a question of this apprenticeship not costing anything to the apprentices, or in fact to their employers over and above the money that's already been taken out of their payroll. It's also that if you don't invest in apprenticeships like this, you're losing that money forever, because you have 2 years to spend it. And if it hasn't been spent in 2 years, it goes back to Treasury and it can't be recovered. So we're having these conversations with the apprenticeship managers to try to get them aware of this possibility and to use this as a mid-career training program and evidence-based intelligence analysis for anybody in policing, or indeed other kinds of agencies that are concerned with crime and work with police, and hoping that people will see that this is a case in which money is not an object. The object is getting the organization and the recruitment and the engagement of the people who want this course, making it possible for them. And like anything else, if you're listening to this and you want to take our apprenticeship, then all you have to do is quietly and diplomatically persevere. And I'm betting that you're going to get onto the course, and I'll look forward to seeing you. It's level four. You don't have to have a university degree. You don't have to have any preparation. We have people who walked out of school at age 15. One of them just has been appointed chief constable, but he came to our master's degree course, not having been in school since he was 15. Didn't have a single A level, and now he's a chief. We love hardworking people who haven't had all the advantages in life, and we encourage everybody who has ambition to learn to come take our course.
That's great. I mean, for those that are listening, this is a great opportunity and one to definitely not be missed. I think once this goes out and people start looking at the perspectives on this apprenticeship, you're going to get a lot of interest, I think, Professor Sherman. I'd just like to say thank you so much for coming on to the ACIA podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure for someone that used to read your work as an undergrad. And yes, I just want to say thank you. And I hope this goes really well. And I will definitely reach out in the future to see how it's going.
Thanks so much, Paige. And I hope we can see you at Cambridge and have future discussions on how we're taking this forward. Thanks again for this opportunity.